Good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome you here to the annual lecture of LEX. As I'm sure you all know, the LEX is the European Institute Discussion Paper Series. It stands for Europe in Question Series, and it was launched in 2009, and it has since then published almost 100 high-quality research papers on Europe from various disciplinary perspectives: law, political science, international relations, social policy, economics, and so on. And it's an extra pleasure that today's speaker of this annual lecture is, in fact, the very man who founded this excellent discussion paper series back in 2009 when he was head of the European Institute, Damien Chalmers. And I'll give a fuller introduction to Damien later, but first we have another important thing to do here, because one of the LEX activities is that we also award biannual, I guess it is, so every other year, a prize to the best doctoral paper on Europe, but can be from any discipline. And therefore, I want to introduce Vasilis Monasteriatis to come and present this year's award.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks, Damien. Thanks, everybody. It's really a pleasure to be standing here and presenting this award. When we started, I'm one of the editors of LEX, and when we started with this idea about having the doctoral paper awards, we're thinking, you know, will we have enough papers in Europe outside the European Institute, and will there be enough interest and so forth? I think on that second occasion that we ran the competition, we kind of have an answer. No, we will not have that many papers from across the LSE, but we have specific departments which do actually ask questions on Europe, not only the European Institute, but other departments, including government, geography, and so forth. Some departments insist not to ask geographically focused questions, so we have few lower representation by them from them. But we do have, in this occasion, two very strong papers that together will share the first prize. So we have a first prize and a second first prize for this year's competition. Allow me to say just a couple of words, since I prepared them for each of these papers, and at the end the authors will know, but at the end I will announce also the names of the winners. So in alphabetical order, the first of the first prize papers is a paper titled "Do Family Values Shape the Pace to Return to Work After Childbirth?" The paper looks in an issue which is particularly interesting, I think, for policy, but also more widely for social science research, looking at the degree to which family values influence the effects and the effectiveness of public policies, specifically in relation, in this case, to the labor market, to the case of women's return to work after childbirth, and whether policy can whether values affect how policy can influence the decision of mothers to return to work. The paper looks at the case of Germany. It applies a very robust, we should say, it's also methodologically sound, empirically rigorous, as the committee said, econometric analysis of German data. And it finds that although obviously there's a direct effectiveness of policy, that family values nevertheless have a significant effect on the decision and the pace with which women return to work after having children. And we think the committee felt that this is a very important contribution to this particular literature, but also more broadly, not only because it talks to the labor economics, if you want, the labor studies literature about the effectiveness of particular activation, female activation measures, as they're called in that literature, but also because it opens up to wider questions about the process of policy harmonization in the European Union. If family values, if cultural values matter, and if the European Union is a union of diverse peoples and polities, then perhaps full harmonization may be counterproductive, may not work everywhere in the same to the same extent in the same place. So we thought that this was a very important contribution. Equally, we thought that another contribution was also very important and very topical, a paper titled "Democratic Responsiveness in the European Union, the Case of the Council." The paper takes the idea that governments respond to people's preferences, so the kind of key criterion for democratic quality, and assesses the responsiveness to public opinion on the particular case of EU politics, looking at the example of government's position taking at the Council, at the European Council. The paper, again, the committee said, offers a well-structured and convincing analysis, and it demonstrates that government's adoption of negotiation positions that reflect public opinion varies significantly with the domestic electoral incentives and constraints. So how governments, whether they respond to public opinion, domestic public opinion, depends on, in a way, the structure of the electorate at home. In particular, responsiveness varies, is higher in majoritarian electoral systems with when elections are imminent and before or immediately after national referendums on the question of Europe. So when the question of Europe becomes prominent in domestic political, I guess, and policy debates. So we think not only in terms of quality, but also in terms of the potential of the paper to make a useful contribution to the debate about the democratic deficit in the EU and also in general representation at the European level of domestic preferences and interests. We think the paper makes a significant contribution also in that, and we were decided to award the first prize also to that paper. So now let me, without further ado, invite Christopher Attil and Mireia Borel to receive the prizes for the papers, for the two papers.
Well, congratulations to the winners, and I believe that, and thank you to Bacillus, and I believe that those papers will be forthcoming in the Lex papers here. So, of course, all of Lex papers are freely downloadable from the European Institute website, so I would obviously encourage you to go and read those papers and all the other excellent papers that can be found on that website. But what I also then, of course, want to turn to is tonight's main event, which is Damian Chalmers' annual lecture for the Lex series. Damian Chalmers, as I'm sure you know, is Professor of European Union Law here at the LSE. He is, of course, the author of the leading textbook on European Union law, I think now in his third edition, with Cambridge University Press. His own research, I think, is uniquely exciting also because of how it bridges EU law with political science perspectives, political philosophy perspectives, looking at the interaction between EU law and domestic political systems. And he's working on this large project that I'm very excited, and I'm sure all of us are, to read the whole book version of, which is What Vision of the Human Condition is Taken by EU Law? I don't know if you'll tell us a bit about that tonight. What he also does beyond this exciting work is that he engages in activities that shapes the future of the European Union in our country when he advises the British government and the British Parliament on what is feasible and what is desirable in terms of EU law and reforming the EU and Britain's own renegotiation of its membership with the European Union. So I really am hoping that whoever will be Prime Minister, probably not next week, but whenever they decide who will be Prime Minister, that he, or I guess it will be a he, that he will take Damian's advice, because I know it will be a better outcome for it. But today, tonight, he'll be speaking on the topic of political community and EU law. So over to you, Damian. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here. I'll stand if that's okay. When I told Sarah about the title, she wasn't sure what the title meant. And I thought, as a way of explaining it, and obviously having an obscure title nicely manages expectations, because if you just explain the title, people think you've already taken them quite far. I thought I'd start by introducing the title by setting out a trilemma. Now, as everyone knows, a dilemma is irresoluble, but a trilemma is three times as hard. If you have a dilemma, which A can't meet B, a trilemma, B can't also meet C, and A can't meet C, as well as A and B. And the trilemma in the case of the EU is three things that have really dominated recent debates. I mean, these are three salient debates that keep coming up not just for lawyers, but for everyone. And they, and I'll explain in a moment, that actually they appear on their face to conflict with one another. Now, the first thing you hear time and time again by almost everyone is that the credibility and the authority of the EU depend on the full application of its law. This was, if you just start, the justification for the current powers of the Court of Justice in the Douay report, which set it up before the Nice Treaty. It was set out that the Court of Justice had to have these powers to ensure that EU law was fully observed. But even if you're not interested in judges, Angela Merkel has time and time again said the reason that Europe is in this mess is that EU laws weren't observed strictly enough, particularly the excessive deficit procedure in relation to budget deficits. And to make sure of this, there are extra strong legal commitments to balance budgets, reams and reams of laws on the six-pack, the two-pack, the fiscal compact, none of which are that well observed, but there's the belief that they should be. And if you think that's a little bit too Euro-enthusiast, well, David Cameron believes very strongly, at least at the moment, that EU law should be observed. When the House of Commons European Scrutiny Committee suggested there should be circumstances when acts of Parliament should take precedence over EU law, and 95 Conservative MPs said this was a very, very good idea indeed. Number 10 said, well, the single market would not be possible without it, and we could not even have an EU-Switzerland-type arrangement without precedence of the international treaty over British law. So everyone seems to believe in this idea. Now, the second idea that I want to talk about a little bit is the one that, once again, dominates debate, that really the authority and credibility of the Union rely on a credible and clever balance of competences, where we know what should be done best by the Union, and what should be done best by member states. Typically, things with transnational spillovers should be done by the Union, acting in accordance with subsidiarity. And the right question is just getting the balance. So this government has had a long balance of competences review, which ensured that the balance is right. It's asked lots of stakeholders. They said it's more or less right, but the government doesn't seem to really like that. The German government has time and time come back to this issue. Angela Merkel has talked about the EU engaging in too much lifestyle regulation, as if the balance of competences isn't quite right. In her view, current critics of the ESM and the EU's management of the crisis have argued it's extended the competences too far in terms of its memoranda of understanding. So once again, you have this idea that if somehow you could just get this balance right, that would be fine. The challenge with that argument, dealing with the first part of the dilemma, is it is inconsistent with the first one. That an argument that talks about the balance of competences is first and foremost a content-dependent argument. We don't require the Czech Republic, Austria, and Slovakia to observe EU law on fisheries to have a common fisheries policy, for example. And not just that, we find in environment policy, some areas of the single market, there's considerable room for differentiation, even deviation from EU law, as we move to various types of soft law. But if you believe firmly in the basis of content-driven policies, where the question is whether the content's right and whether it puts too much constraints on it, law can be too rigid an instrument. And it's not clear you always need the commitments from others. There might be a whole range of other things. Now, the third thing that has been fairly central to debates, particularly here in the UK, is the question of public opinion. The cliche that the EU has moved more towards a constraining dissensus has been matched by, I think, to my mind, some of the most interesting research currently on the EU, certainly the stuff I've learned most about, which has moved debates on what, if you like, shapes public views about the EU. So as I understand, it's increasingly informed of a variety of narratives, which might include cues from government's elites, people's perceptions of those elites, narratives about national identity, arguments about political accountability, which Sarah has written extensively on. And some people also talk about what I've called in a rather jargonic way, grid-group relations. There's this argument that more individualistic and anti-authoritarian people tend to be more suspicious of the EU, where those that are more communitarian paradoxically might be more sympathetic to it. And the challenge that this debate puts for the other two is it suggests that public opinion is much more labile and unstable for these two, other two to apply in a credible, authoritative way. If public opinion is so central to what we think of the EU, then of course law struggles, particularly when you require supermajorities to change it, for its responsiveness. And the idea you can ever have a stable balance of competences, which nicely divides public opinion in a way that's sympathetic to the EU, is challenging. So that's the trilemma. Now, if that trilemma was right, this was just like it was, there's a real challenge for the EU. And I really want to say that it misses something and perhaps offer a way, modestly or immodestly, of resolving it. So, now, what I'm going to say first of all about this trilemma, this is why I call it falses, there's certain things that just do not seem to fit into it. This is the stuff I read, which is the stuff that appears in The Sun and the Daily Mail. And if you read most of the stuff that seems to seep into consciousness, they talk about things that don't seem to be mediated by this triangle a lot of the time. Now, one of the things that has dominated British journalistic debate, and it's still going on, and it's not just the newspapers now, it's all the law journals, is the case of Damian Vnuk. Now, Damian Vnuk, in case you haven't heard him, was a Slovenian farmer who was rather unlucky. He climbed a ladder back in 2007. He still hasn't got compensation in 2015, as I understand it. And while he was climbing a ladder, someone backed a tractor with a trailer into the ladder. He fell off and hurt himself. And the question was, and this is what resolved, went all the way up to the Court of Justice via the Slovenian Supreme Court, whether this was covered by motor insurance, by compulsory motor insurance. There are EU directives that require all motor vehicles which ride on public roads to be compulsorily insured. And you can make a strong reason, argument for that. We don't want someone to be run over on the roads here in the UK by someone that's uninsured, whether they have a vehicle that's registered here in the UK and any other EU state. Now, the question that went to the Court of Justice, which was not resolved by the 1972 directive, was whether the insurance covered driving on private property. And the Court of Justice said it was. It was a willing interpretation that could have gone either way. And at this point, the British press got very upset because it means that golf buggies, lawnmowers that you drive may require compulsory insurance. And this has taken a life of its own. It's gone on and on. The British government's got very excited about it as an example of Brussels bureaucracy. And if you go back to this trilemma, I think no one claims that the single market is going to collapse whether you require insurance for a golf buggy on some suburban golf course or not. Whether it's a good thing or not is another matter. In terms of balance of competences, the 1972 directive is a really very established single market directive. No one really is arguing it should disappear. And finally, I would say it struggles, as I understand it, to fit into most of the narratives about public opinion on the micro level. So there are cases which don't seem to fit into this, and they're quite common. The other things that have dominated British debate are the end of marigold gloves, that the EU is suggesting basically marigold gloves don't protect you from the washing up liquid. These are the washing up gloves that the British love. They're no good. They're dangerous for you. The EU has said get things that are less bad for your hands. And they also want to get oven gloves that actually protect you above 200 degrees centigrade. The press is very upset about that. And halogen bulbs, which the Commission wants to outlaw. It's required to. It was meant to review them in 2009. And this could be very, very expensive indeed. But the halogen bulbs debate, which actually has the most distributive consequences, is actually the one that's been least recited in the press. None of these case studies fit in to the trilemma that I said. Secondly, there are case studies which cut across the logic. Let's go back to David Cameron's best hour, the budget surcharge row. I choose these two examples because they happened within 2 weeks of each other. The budget surcharge row was when David Cameron believed, because of readjustments by Eurostat, that he had to stump up, well, he didn't personally, but British had to stump up an extra £1.7 billion as part of their budgetary contribution. He got angry. He said it would affect any referendum. The renegotiations was just the stuff that shouldn't happen. And until someone told him that he'd get back half the money because of the rebate. But it went round and round in the press, largely most of the other political parties cravenly supported Cameron without finding out the facts. As I understand it, he hadn't bothered to do so because he had last minute before he went into the European Council. So this generated huge heat. Now, this case you may not have heard. It was a case based on a judgment from the Court of Justice, which was called Locke. This was a case of an employment appeal tribunal. And what this was about was it was a case that said that you had to calculate overtime in deciding how much holiday pay was paid. Okay. Now, this judgment was a highly arguable interpretation of the Organisation of Working Time Directive, a directive who the Conservative and much of the right of centre Britain highly contests. The EEF, a very pro-EU industrial group, estimated it would put 3% on employer costs. I suspect this was, as with all of these things, a slight overestimate. These are unevenly distributed. It will affect small and medium-sized enterprises probably more than larger costs. And they're unevenly distributed across amongst workers as well. Now, this case, it was reported largely on the basis of English law. There was a big debate about it. The EU dimension was almost excluded, even though the Employment Appeal Tribunal just followed the Court of Justice. And if you'd followed the logic I suggested in the trilemma, one would almost have expected these to reverse. It was unpredictable, the incidence of aggravation. If public opinion has been very good at explaining aggravation and suggesting that EU lawyers are too doctrinaire, we still have to think why it happens where it does, at least at the micro level. And the third point I want to raise, and this is what I'll come back to, is certain longitudinal questions. First longitudinal question in my area is since 2004, judicial resistance to EU law, and these are all senior judicial courts, or acts of the EU institutions, has taken off. Amongst over half the member states, there's been significant acts by senior courts of judicial resistance, and it's almost all since 2004. Why is this happening? It can't be put down to public opinion or judges responding to public opinion because it doesn't correlate. What is going on? And this brings, and this is where I engage in a bit of speculation, about when we talk about the EU, particularly about public opinion, is it possible that the basis for public opinion on the EU, and I'm not talking about how the preferences are expressed, may have changed because the EU law does different things. What I mean by that is not just the EU law transgresses more on certain things, so it might have greater distributive qualities. But if it, for example, started off as a regulatory state, it might not be surprising that people experience the EU based more along material lines. Public reporting of the EU, certainly of EU law, until 2000 looked at it purely in cost-benefit analysis. Now it doesn't. And there's a question, maybe because EU does certain things, the way people base their preferences, is it the same? This is an unanswerable question, so it's a bit of poor research design. Is it the same as it was 15, 20, 10 years ago? Now, this is where it comes to political community. This is my hypothesis. And it's speculation, but I want to set it out there and then set out what law adds to this. One of the challenges with the trilemma is that it sets out as if the EU as a blank canvas. It says there's this issue of migration or there's this issue of the euro. What do people think about it? It's almost like it's just a policy. And this isn't true for everything. But what you find is, in a lot of the debates, either it focuses just on the policy or the government response, or it sets out a narrative that goes back to 1066. And I want to suggest there is also an intermediate place, that debates about EU activities take place against what I'm going to call an institutional legacy. But when people think about EU policies, they also think about their assumptions of what the EU and domestic settlements have done in recent times, institutionally. And this is an extra complicating variable. I'm not saying the others are unimportant or irrelevant, but to my mind, intuitively, it matters. Now, the issue about the human condition goes to what I think the EU does, and I'm not going to talk about that. Now, what I'm going to say is the institutional context and legacy that exists, i.e. assumptions about what the EU and member states, is surprisingly common, in my view, across member states. And I think one can see that in some extent in what one sees on the Eurobarometer. And the way this is articulated, this is what I'll say, is that people are, historically, it might be changing, less clear about what the EU does. There's a grand narrative. But they set it off that it must not transgress. They have some assumptions about what domestic settlements do. Okay? And the view is that the European Union, EU law, should not transgress ideas of domestic political community. They have this idea that domestic settlements must first and foremost do political community. I'll say what that is in a moment. And so far as EU law transgresses in that, people become quite unhappy. Now, why do I say political community? The idea of political community, I say, it sets out a political theology for nation states. Political community says out, this is what's valuable and important that we do, and this is what isn't. Okay? It differentiates between different types of activities and introduces a calculus of value. Now, that, I'll explain what political community is in a moment. But I'll just set out my hypothesis in a rather abstract way, and I'll get back to EU law, or the EU. Now, what happened up until 2000, in my view, was that domestic narratives of political community were surprisingly effectively well mediated by both national executives and national judges. What happened was, whenever the union did something people thought was important, it would either be managed away, typically through the enforcement procedure, by national governments doing a deal with the commission so it wouldn't be too strongly enforced, or actually national judges would protect the domestic settlement from the European Union. The consequence was people only heard about the EU as something in Brussels. Its effects on the ground in terms of political community were quite limited. This threatened to break down this protection of domestic community in the 90s, and did break down from about 2000 onwards, in my view. And I'll go through it in a moment. Once this broke down, and the EU began doing generalised things that upset people's ideas of political community, you get a much more aggressive resistance to the European Union from national courts. You get, and this is where I speculate a bit, a much more turbulent debate, a less institutionalised views of political community start emerging, attaching to all aspects of EU law. And this is where we are now, and this is why I say we have to find a new settlement. So going back to this, what I argue is that there isn't a full application of EU law anymore. It's a much more mediated application, which is much more vulnerable to public opinion. But public opinion is influenced by assumptions about what the EU does, I think, at least as I see it in the debates. I can't talk to a micro level. This was a managerial way of dealing with things that is now largely bypassed. It's not working. It's the old institutional way of doing things. Now, that's the argument, and I've got about 15, 20 minutes to do it, so I'll just say, first of all, political community is, and then I'll say how I propose to look at it. Well, political community has two aspects to it. There's a what is a political community and a who is a political community. No political community really exists as a diaspora. There might be an ethnic or a racial community, but they are not a political community. So the Cornish are not a political community. It's not saying they might not want to become one or whatever. They are not a political community. They might have their own rights, etc. And one can talk about various other minorities. Historically, central to being a political community, and one sees this in eastern Ukraine at the moment, this is what the big debate about is, you have a system of rule. A political community can only exist if it has a political system. And a system of rule is something that orders and describes, emanates from the 8th century and monastic life. What difference rule from other forms of laws is they don't just order life, you must do this, but they describe a way of life. So the monastic life, where the rule came from, described how people behaved as well as told them what they had to do. And to that end, they do a number of things. Rule is both general, it orders time, it orders space. The word inhabitant actually comes from the monk's habit, indicating a particular way of organizing your life and distinguishing yourself from other communities, etc. Now, a political community is not just a system of rule, but it is also, there is a who we are. When we talk about a political community, one assumes association of people. Now, when it first started off, the idea of political community was based around sovereignty and the idea of the body politic. And the body politic had the idea that the monarch was both the king himself, but he represented the whole community. And the community was expressed in corporeal terms. So it was assumed to have organological qualities, so it was compared to a body. It was seen as eternal because the king went on forever. There was a certain dignity to it because the king was special. And finally, the body politics was seen as a lived experience. Everyone was part of it. It included everyone. Now, with the decline of monarchy, political community got based not around the body so much, but the idea of a human order. You can call it a nation, a society, a people, a public, which had some of these qualities. That if you look at, if one thinks about society or the nation, these are seen as indivisible terms, as something eternal, goes backwards and forwards, something's special for some people. And over time, there have been two aspects which emerged, this sort of from the 18th century onwards, and this is from that time as well. One is enclosure, territory. There was the idea of enclosure as something that demarcated off the political community, not just to protect it, but also to mark it off as civilized versus the outside. It was used to establish title to territory, the right to tax, and all these things, to justify administrative power. Alongside that, political community, the idea of political communities, been associated with two forms of community. By that I mean association. But in a political community, there are what I call communities of shared activities. We do things together, we have policies. But the communities of co-presence, that if you think of a nation, you're a member of a nation, you're British, no matter what you do. Just by being present in the territory, perhaps having a shared passport, we exist. Okay? So, system of rule, the political community is based around a system of rule, which sets out a way of life, a way of organising yourself, and a system of human association, based particularly strongly around the idea that there must be both co-presence and you must do certain things together. Okay. Now, how did this come together in EU law? The European Union was challenged this because the EU came along and said, you can't do certain things. The EU will do some. We'll do these things instead. Okay. So it challenged the idea of political community. States had to make a decision. What was it they were going to allow the EU to do? Not just at the level of Brussels, and what not. What was important to keep for themselves, not just when they agree treaties, but when the EU engages in competence creep or the unanticipated consequences, and what do they keep for themselves? And they used this idea of political community, which was embodied particularly strongly in the idea of sovereignty, to say this is the area that we must keep off for ourselves. So they were particularly concerned to stop EU law from destabilizing systems of order, which in particular went to expressing understandings of co-presence, setting out who we, not so much who what we do, but who we are together. And to make this a little bit abstract, I'll set this out more clearly. What did it break down to? It broke down to three things that they were going to protect at all costs. Firstly, political community, this is linked to rule. Rule precedes law. So this is the member states retained the right to found the political system. This is the potestas, is the right to found rule. Auctoritas is the right to grant it authority. You see this most strongly in the competence debate. No possible exception of Croatia, no state has ever sort of really said that the EU has this. Secondly, linked to rule is what someone's called the right to let live, the right of subjection. They have never given if you want to put it in big terms, the right to impose obligations on private parties directly, significant obligations. The EU has very limited rights there. Of course. Now the third one, and this is where it comes to my rather abstract discussion about communities of co-presence. What happened when the EU challenges national systems laws is it challenges national laws. It says you can't do this, you can't do that. So they had to reify this rather abstract of the idea of the body politic, of community of co-presence, into laws that were seen as expressing these qualities most acutely, and these laws were to be protected, and other ones weren't. So which laws were to be protected? Well, the first thing of a political community is it has organological qualities. It's thought of in qualities like the human body. So where we think of things that are indivisible, when we refer to society, common values such as crime, tax, for the collective good, this is an indivisible thing. These are areas of law that historically states and courts have been very wary about giving to. Secondly, going back to the historical idea of political community, political community has a certain dignity, the office of the king. So things like territory, offices surrounding parliament, government, these are protected at all costs from the EU. Thirdly, there's this idea that the nation goes back to beyond the mists of time, and we'll go forward to the mists of time. It's eternal. Human order, this goes to fundamental rights. National courts in particular said the EU can develop your own fundamental rights, but you're not touching ours. There's the idea of citizenship as something that goes on forever. And you have other associations that are seen as eternal, such as religious laws. And finally, the idea of political community, going back to the body politic, laws that express particularly saliently lived experience. Ideas such as culture, tradition, family and education. Now my argument is quite simply, the EU never did any of these things until 2000, when it occasionally transgressed, it got pushed back. In 2000 it started doing particularly this, and that is where we are now, and this has led to some of the challenges. Okay? Now let's get back to Europe. I'm going to say there were five stages to the history of EU authority, or authority in Europe. Okay? Each stage was marked by a crisis, which allowed you to move to the next stage. Okay? And I'll just take you through the stages. The crisis could be exogenously outside events, or the EU could do something that could generate it that moves you on. The first stage was the stage of territorial sovereignty. This existed, I'll say, from the First World War to the, I should say, to 1950, that's unfair, to 1945. This was where states said, basically, we don't want any foreign law on our territory. Very strong territoriality. It's emerged for a particular version of the nation state that emerged in the late 18th, early 19th century. The challenge with this was it didn't lead to good things, either in terms of world trade, with the protectionism around 1930, and it obviously manifested itself in unpleasant ways with the Second World War. Second World War, you move to a bizarre end of history moment that beats anything of 1990, where everyone is cuddly and changes their constitutions and says, we will pass all the power over to international organisations and we'll be ruled by them. Not just they can limit our rule, but they can do whatever they like. By the early 1950s, they've realised this is a very bad idea. The only people that said it was a bad idea was Ibsen, who was a German negotiator at the European Coal and Steel Community. But he'd also been a Nazi, so it wasn't the best messenger for making this point. The third area, though, is what I call splitting. The EU does not start to get significant direct powers until the end of the transitional period. And then all this notional stuff goes out of the window. For the first time, they have to think, what are they going to do? And so splitting is a psychological term that denies reality. So there's a black and white world. Well, the EU law doesn't really matter, and all the action is still here. And they try to do that all the way to 2000, even as the EU gets more powers. Now, this next significant stage is and this is an endogenous change, is Maastricht and Amsterdam. They agree to powers which clearly all courts agree, most citizens think, citizenship, the euro, area of freedom, immigration, asylum, transgress on established notions of political community. Courts have to anticipate that, but none of these powers kick in until after 2000. The euro doesn't, area of freedom, security and justice doesn't, and citizenship doesn't in a very limited way on the ground. 2000, 2004, you get the endogenous results of the euro, immigration and asylum the limit, but you also get enlargement, which brings out so that citizenship, which was affecting relatively small numbers by large in Central and East Europe in particular, now starts affecting numbers in a significant way. And this is when you start getting generalized rule. These are not the formal things, but in this case, there were different things that happened. Now, I'll go through very briefly how, I've got another 15 minutes, how do courts, administrations respond to them. I've done a longitudinal analysis that starts out before the EU to show a certain continuity. Right, going back before the mists of time to late 19th century, early 20th century, up until 1939, everyone in Europe was first of all deeply sceptical, well not everyone, but many were sceptical about international treaties. Very few states were what was called monist before the Second World War, that has allowed international law to be applied directly in their territories. It was very, very rare indeed. The idea was it should not have international laws, foreign law should not be applied in the domestic territory. International law was seen as a polarizing presence. German international lawyers saw it as deeply ideological to impose particularly the Treaty of Versailles. The French, of course, international lawyers, of course, loved it. Everyone else saw it as, yes, not the voice of reason that some people see it now. And there were deep debates and divisions about international jurisdiction. War crimes tribunals were actually an invention of the first one. They were in Europe. They were meant to be set up after the First World War to try Bulgarians and Germans, but everyone agreed that international tribunals were a bad idea. They never really took off in Bulgaria. There were a few domestic trials as a result in Germany, but there was strong resistance to it. The idea of international coordination was seen as mainly an academic concern. There was worries about international trade, there was worries about the way states treated each other, where they treated people within them, and so you got academics talking about it, but it was largely confined as an academic discussion. Territory was so strong. And the only mechanism for mediating political community, the idea that a foreign law should ever apply in the territory of another state, was private international law. And they used devices, which were sort of hidden devices. Vested rights, as a contract is agreed in one state and executed in another. And the argument is, should the idea of people carry the contract. This was the argument, like a suitcase. They sort of agreed. And Bismarck, for example, initially thought it did challenge sovereignty, was against it, and then the Germans changed their mind. And the argument was always to say this territoriality is important. The challenges with this were obviously led to very unstable things in terms of international trade. This is where you get standardization developing during this time. So people find surrogate mechanisms. And you get rather ugly manifestations of political community. And Second World War, leads to a huge change in how states conceive political community. And the big constitutional moment is actually in the 40s. There is both the Congress for the Council of Europe, where they talk about transfer of sovereignty in the negotiations, but of the original six, all of them bar Belgium. And Belgium only didn't modify its constitution, it modified it in 1970, but its practice was already this, modify their constitution to basically say international civil servants can govern their countries in an unlimited way. There's a power in many of these constitutions for transfer of unlimited powers to international organizations, precedence over international law. The French equivocate a little bit, but they say it must be reciprocation by other states. The Dutch, having done it initially in 1953, by 1956, think this is a very bad idea indeed, and say it will only be the case if what they say the treaty is directly applicable, general rights for individuals. But this is the big constitutional moment. They all say sovereignty can not just be limited, but you can transfer unlimited sovereignty. This allows the Court of Justice to cheat a bit. In Van Gendelen-Loos and Costa, the famous cases where the ECJ says the EU can limit sovereignty of member states and generate rights for individuals. If you look at the judges at the time, they were all Christian Democrat politicians linked to these families. How long have I got?
Oh, you've got another 15 minutes.
Okay. And what they said was, well, if national constitutional courts say this, we think the EU should be able to say this as well. They used the same language. The arrogance was in an international court or an EU court imposing this, rather than being an act of self-limitation. And it didn't really matter, because the only treaty provisions that were directly enforcing were largely those on customs duties and charges having equivalent effect, and industrial goods that had been largely, been heavily reduced during the Kennedy round. The EU was, of course, able to meet its deadline for the customs union 2 years early. So this was almost a completely notional question right up to 1970. This is the period where they say, international organisations can do what they like, but we're not going to actually give them anything to do. The challenge was, of course, they put in time a, you know, I wouldn't say a time bomb, but it paves the way. It's allowed during that period for some just significant legal networks to develop, a process of this has been in place for a long time, and a centre of gravity to change. Now, this is a rather big slide. What happens after 1970? 1970, you suddenly have a position, and you start to actually get significant amounts of EU law agreed also in the 70s in quite contestable areas such as environmental law, labour law, the single market gets quite extensive legislation, where this notional idea doesn't work. And I'll come on to the last. Firstly, all national constitutional courts now have to consider what do they do about EU law. Even those courts which are the most enthusiastic about EU law, which is the Belgian Court of Arbitrage and the SCI, say EU law is authorisable. They say the Belgian Court of Arbitrage said the EU law takes precedence, it takes precedence over our constitution, but only because our constitution authorises it so. Okay? All the others say a similar thing. Secondly, what about the principle of subjection? What really bothered national courts during this time was the idea that EU law could impose obligations on private individuals. In fact, the first case that the German Constitutional Court considered this in 1967, it said it has no public law. It has no idea of directly enforcing individuals. And what one finds is, this happens time and again in national courts. The treaties, there was one provision that did, which was equal pay for work of equal value for men and women. Regulations had the possibility to impose obligations on individuals, horizontal direct effect, but you can't find a case where this was actually the case. The big debate was about directives, which made many of whose provisions made provision for imposing obligations directly on private individuals. In France, Germany, and this is less well known, except in the Rad van Staat, the Netherlands, they all said directives cannot impose obligations on individuals. And there was not really a strong case, despite the fact the Court of Justice said it in the mid-70s, of any senior national court saying that that would be the case right through to the 80s, until the Court of Justice changes its case law and says you can individuals can invoke directives against the state, but no one can invoke individuals against other individuals, not directly at least. They were able to get away with this because actually very little EU law generated any rights at all. In a study I did of the UK, and it's not unusual, I chose the end of the period, 1992, there were only 55 reported decisions. And by then, everything was on. You can 26th on one instrument, the VAT directive, 10 on sex discrimination law, the next most were 4 on agricultural law and 4 on labour law. Labour law is transfer of undertakings. This is very, very small. So most obligations were negotiated by domestic civil servants with the Commission through the enforcement procedure, where there was heavy mediation. Very little went to the Court of Justice, and this gives states a lot of leeway in tweaking EU legislation, along with, in many cases, such as environmental legislation, long guidelines. Alongside this, early decisions by constitutional courts sort of made clear that they were going to protect the body politic. German constitutional court, in its first case, mentioned it, said it should not affect public law, not affect politics, obligations on or the political realm. The French Constitutional Council, its first case, which was on the own resources decision, said the fundamental elements of sovereignty must not be affected. This is not a significant budgetary decision, as it saw. And the biggest example was the Italian Constitutional Court, when it first considered it, when it said EU law could have primacy, it said it can only do that because it only governs economic matters, not civil, socio-ethical relations, or political relations. They all ring-fence the idea of political community. And this happens time and time again during the 80s. The Irish courts did it on foreign policy, the British and French did it on immigration. Okay? Now, all through the 90s, this actually continues. That all that happens between 1993 and 2000, if you look at the mediation, is they have to find a fix about directives. So what they say about directives is that that individuals' obligations are imposed on individuals by national law, but it must be interpreted in the light of the directive. The formal subjection is by national law. And where this is too much of a fiddle, which is criminal law, this is the real exercise of the sovereign, they say this interpretive duty does not apply in the field of criminal liability. And you continue to have very limited direct rule. Both, you can see this both in the preliminary reference procedure, and these are cases in the UK. And during that period, even the Belgian Court d'Arbitrage does its best to protect the body politic. It rules that the EU cannot decide on matters of education policy. It's largely to do with issues about, you know, the linguistic divisions in Belgium. However, this period is significant not for the continuation so much, but for what it promised. You have three things that come up that had to be considered by constitutional courts, by no one else, which went to the idea of political community. Well, not by just the constitutional, but Denmark is an exception to that. The euro, the citizenship, and the area of freedom, security, and justice. The most vigorous position is taken by Denmark. They said basically the protocol is not a member matter even for courts. Political institutions will ring-fence this off. They ring-fenced off area of freedom, security, and justice, the euro, and to a large extent on citizenship. And to give an idea of the strength of feeling of Danish political institutions on citizenship, when the Metock decision was given in 2008, there's a decision from Ireland about whether EU citizens could, in this case Irish citizens, could go to the UK to marry an asylum seeker and then bring them back to Ireland. So it was the right of, under EU law, to marry an asylum seeker and the right to remain. The Danish Parliament, well, there was extensive protest in the Danish Parliament, and they rewrote a large part of their immigration law to try and marginalise the effect of this decision, for better or for worse. France, taken in my view the most honest position, the French Constitutional Council, both at Maastricht and at Amsterdam, they said all these things require encroach on political community, we can't have anything to do with them unless France amends its constitution, which they did. Germany was, well, it's between Germany and Spain for the least honest position. Germany says these things are really important, particularly the euro. This is not a limited power, this goes to the nature of political community, but they said that stable inflation is a precondition for democratic community, and it's more important that we have stable inflation than a democracy. Something that many Germans have come back to. They said you can't have one without the other. So there's a sort of a raison d'etre almost. It's a very odd form of decision making. Then you have Spain. Spain was the only state that said this did not affect political community, the Spanish Constitutional Court. And it did so for quite idiosyncratic Spanish arguments. The Spanish Constitutional Court looked particularly at EU citizenship. And it said EU citizenship, the Spanish had only given EU citizens the right to vote in municipal authorities. And they said these are not governed by the Constitution or the statutes of autonomy. And as they're not governed by either of these things, the things that govern the autonomous communities or the central authorities, it therefore doesn't go to our notion of political community. These municipal elections just aren't very important, as far as we're concerned, just decide where the bins are, so it doesn't go to political community. But you have here a consistent concern by other states about protecting against political community. Now, what then happens from 2000, 2003, 2004 onwards? You have states coming along who now look at the state of play when they join. These are 2004, 2007 entrants. You have the growth of significant deployment of citizenship rights, actually from 2009 onwards. That's when they become significant in terms of... And you have the euro entering into force in a significant way from 1999. What do we see? We see generalised disobedience from judges. First of all, You find disobedience is more common than avoidance. Laws which express organological qualities. So health laws, laws about social justice, tax laws, pensions, budget control. All these courts have said that these types of laws are not acceptable. Whatever the EU says, they will apply nationally. The most strident have been the Portuguese Constitutional Tribunal and the Czech Constitutional Court. They have been equally strong about protecting national citizenship laws and national fundamental rights laws. Anyone that's any doubt of that should look at what the German Constitutional Court said about EU fundamental rights jurisprudence in relation to its security laws. Finally, you see states that have come out and said very clearly that the EU should not, these courts should not touch on things like foreign policy, defence, or issues of public office. The UK Supreme Court was not having the EU coming along and saying that Parliament's Act on HS2 was illegal because Parliament hadn't done a proper strategic environmental assessment. They said, look, we could solve a few people, that's enough. And finally, Germany, Poland have been very insistent about family law, religious law, and education. So this is a generalised resistance. I don't want to get too much of my pay grade. But one of the interesting things about public opinion, as I understand it, and I'll be shot down, I'm sure, for being wrong, is you see a dip. The median public opinion in Europe, both in terms of who thinks the EU is a good thing and who thinks it's a bad thing in Europe barometer, is relatively consistent, bar a few outliers. And it changes in a significant way, in my view, about spring 2010. If I just get the statistics, and it's been relative. Let me just get the numbers if I can find them. Here we go. Between 1980 and 2010, once again, the UK is an outlier, and this is. You find a position where those who were saying the EU membership was a good thing was between 45 and 50% in most states, and those who are saying it's a bad thing is between 15 and 20%. This changes from spring 2010 onwards. It goes to about a good thing to about 35 to 40%, a bit higher, a bad thing to about 25 to 30. It's gone down, it's improved a bit if you're pro-EU in recent times. But if you looked at the bad, that's a significant shift. And that's obviously has been significant political activity. But what is and that's normally ascribed to the crisis. Now, what I don't understand is, if that is so, then why did it happen in spring 2010? I'm not saying the crisis wasn't important, but the crisis had not started in public opinion then, especially if you look at Eurobarometer. 2010 is relevant if you bear in mind that most states had to give welfare entitlements, and this is to A8 nationals from 2009 onwards. This is when they acquired full right, not just the right of movement, which it had in some states, but full welfare rights. And I don't want to make an argument against this. I think immigration is a fantastic thing. But in terms of political salience and political contestation, that date coincides with two things. Two, if you like, perfect storms. The contestation surrounding internal EU migration and all that's involved, and the euro area. Both areas that go to political questions of political community, both areas that have not been able to be mediated very effectively by courts or administrations. And this has allowed, of course, more pejorative, more racist notions of political community to emerge. Now, can I just have 5 minutes? I'll just say why I think, I'll go back to something I wrote about with Policy Network, why I think the current way of doing things, trying to hive off certain areas which we think don't affect political community the EU can do, and then reserving political community for nation state, member states, doesn't work anymore. Estrangement. This goes to why political community is a good thing. Political community is a very dangerous thing, but it does three things that are very important. First of all, it secures trust in a political system. It's all very saying everything is great, but why should I trust the British to do great things rather than the French or anyone else? Secondly, it secures sacrifice. It's not just the right to kill or be killed, but things like the right to be taxed. The amount I'm taxed is not the amount I would give to any friend. One does it, the image of society comes from notions of the family, which has been fairly central to sacrifice. And thirdly, it introduces a particular notion of public reason, which is based on us as a community of free and equals, which emphasises our sameness and our difference. Even though we're different, we are the same for the purposes of the political community. And so ideas such as autonomy, kinship, fundamental rights, justice not as solidarity based on difference, but as a mutual commitment, representation, are all based around notions of political community. EU law can disrupt those, whether it's in any area of activity you think about. It's not just education law or tax law. So saying, dividing it up in this way doesn't make sense. The problems with political community are, of course, it's more less attractive elements. It's racist, nationalist elements. Its interlocutors are often opportunist. And it's often used to justify administrative centralization. Now, because we now have a deorganized, deinstitutionalized forms of political community being expressed, in response to this, and neither the European Union nor member states is able to mediate conflicts in a very acceptable way, you have this sort of appalling statements that one hears, I'd say, well, I thought some of Nigel Farage's comments about Romanians were completely unacceptable and racist. And these sort of deinstitutionalized things begin to emerge, and there is no place for them to be politically contested. And that is in part because we no longer have proper containers of conflict. Now, what I suggested for this was a test of relative democratic authority, and I'll just briefly explain why I think this. I think democracy means two things. It's a state of affairs and a process. As a state of affairs, it has three elements to it. This is not on the slide. First of all, there's a procedural element, government by the people for the people. So there's an element that there must be some procedures to express collective preferences, be they representative, participatory, deliberative, it doesn't matter. Thirdly, there's an ethic. It is not democratic for the majority to say we will kill the minority. You know, there is an idea that we're all of an equal worth. And thirdly, it is not democratic to say the world is made of cheese. There's a concern, this is an epistemic element, an element of correctness. Now, your balance between them doesn't matter. Everyone, this is where our theories of democracy contested each other. But what they mean is that EU can only act democratically in certain circumstances. It pursues transnational goods that cannot be pursued by a nation state, pursues transnational bads that cannot be protected from by the nation state, enhances problem solving in a way that cannot be realised by the member state, and perhaps allows us to reimagine political community. So the EU has been very good at putting forward anti-discrimination legislation, for example. So that has to be one part of the test. But of course there will be democratic costs alongside any of these things. So it has to be weighed against the democratic costs. And that is not a legal test, it's a political judgment. It's a test of collective action. As a process, my argument is that you require two things for democracy: contestation, competition for office, and responsiveness or accountability. Now, the EU does not have the latter because there's a monopoly of initiative, and I do not think there's sufficient contestation between the European Parliament and the Council to ensure the level of contestation one would want in democracy. That's my personal view. I say you have to change this a bit. If you could create a test of relative democratic authority, you could create a container to deal with these conflicts. It's an argument why the EU should do more, but it's also an argument for, if you like, a more flexible EU. Now, my first suggestion is that you should have a situation where EU law only becomes law if 2/3 of national laws of parliaments approve it. They have different constituencies, and the power to decide is then subject to contestation, away from Brussels. In terms of democratic responsiveness, I argue you should have a proposal for revision. That can be amendment, repeal, or new laws. If 1/3 of national laws, parliaments propose it. This allows EU law to be responsive and allows competition over agenda setting. However, that is not enough, because we have political community at a domestic level. We have to have contestation at that level. So it should be possible for national parliaments to ask for suspension of EU law. Anyone who doesn't think that's possible is possible in Norway, and its transposition rate is as good as the EU. And by the way, as I've told you, most national governments do not comply with most EU law most of the time. It's just agreed. It's just a done deal in secret between them and the Commission. This is more transparent and actually may ensure better. However, there's a problem, because the party political system of states within the EU does not mediate protest very well, because the main parties have to be in pro-EU. So this is why I say you need a citizens' initiative as well to ensure proper contestation. Who represents the 35% or whatever of citizens that do not believe in the EU? However much you may disagree with them. Now, the final thing I said is you require democratic situating. If you're part of a community, and people like Bonnie Honegger argue this, you can't just say, well, we'll disapply EU law. Tough. You must take the consequences of its effect on others, which in this case is other EU citizens, other EU states. So I say you should, first of all, it would only be allowed to be disapplied if there was an impact assessment, which showed clearly the advantages to the national territory and how to minimise its effects. And then you send it to COSAC or any other body, and national parliament, other national parliaments decide if this is worth the candle. They may want to disapply their own national laws. And if they're unhappy with it, it gets sent to the European Council, which can provide for the possibility of retaliatory measures to look for a political solution. My view is these things are a matter of politics, not of law. And because they're a matter of politics, you have to have a situation where conflicts can be expressed and conflicts addressed. And ultimately, if they really can't be resolved, it must go back to the national territory, as it has the most resilient containers for conflict. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Damien, for that excellent talk. We now are lucky to have about 20 minutes for questions. I'm sure this talk must have inspired and provoked some questions. Yes.
Damien, I just wanted to bring the matter back to the issue of perception.
Issue of perception, which you briefly touched on in the beginning. And that is the perception towards what the political community is, how that perception is defined. In other words, linking it back to political leadership, who's dominating the narrative, in other words, locally, within the community, independently of the of Europe. And obviously Farage would be a good example of that.
Thank you for that question. It's a really interesting question. Because my argument is that because these debates have been deinstitutionalized, it's allowed for very opportunistic invocation of political community. So there's people like Farage. But let me give you an example I enjoyed much more, which was marigold gloves. When I gave this talk to the lawyers, they got very upset that they wouldn't have marigold kitchen gloves, which have been a staple of British life. Now, you wonder how these stories got out. And, of course, it had been leaked by the government minister who was involved. It was a cue from the British negotiators that they thought if they could get the press on their side, it would be good for domestically. And so you got this story. We're keeping Brussels out of the kitchen sink. All the narratives and the Telegraph, the Times, the Daily Mail, where Brussels must not, we must protect the British kitchen sink from the interference of Brussels. Now, there was nothing about the fact that marigold gloves don't work, they're a quite inferior product, that they're damaging, or any of the basis for this. And I may be being unfair, but I don't think they're really a strong central tradition of British life. That we took, you know, when you have the British citizenship test that people have to pass, there'll be lots of discussions about marigold gloves. And if you can answer what they are, you get a British passport, and if you can't, you don't. So you get these opportunistic uses of political community, which in my view are very dangerous. They're dangerous because they can be racist and unpleasant, both towards communities within the territory and outsiders. But they actually devalue the currency of political community. We use the language of political community because it actually does things that are quite important for political life, notably trust, sacrifice, and a certain quality of public reason. And if we have these ludicrous, if we think politics is about discussing the kitchen sink, it generates a contempt for politics.
Chris?
Thank you. Thanks very much. I found this very interesting, this idea of, once the EU trembled into body politics and really tried to intervene at that front, that's actually a turning point probably in public opinion. And the challenges for this are, I disagree to some extent that public opinion has been very stable over the last 40 years. I think there was last year Mark Franklin giving a talk here where he told us about the three big crises in Euroscepticism, which is the crazy cow crisis, the Eurosclerosis crisis, and especially if we think of the heights of public opinion when there was really much support. It's interesting, it's in the beginning of the 1990s, with the completion of the single market, but then also around the Maastricht Treaty, which is foundational for all this, where public opinion is actually quite strong, and then it ebbs, of course. And I think another thing is, which is challenging for this thesis, is that where has public opinion stayed more supportive of the union? And it's clearly within the core that participates in all these policy areas. Especially in support and in support for specific policies, the EU6 has seen the least downward trend compared to the periphery, and I think this is something that troubles this neat explanation of a connection between going into notions of political community and diminishing public support?
I think it's a very fair criticism, that, and I have to be careful. This doesn't test in any way at all, let alone a rigorous way, a determinant of political community. It says there is something out there that we might like to consider. And let me just deal with a couple of issues of what you say. You rightly say there's been significant jumps and deflections in public opinion around about Mad Cow. There was obviously the uptick in public, a significant uptick in public opinion around the Single European Act. And they are there, I agree. And one has it round about the crisis as well. But what I found as interesting, and this is a very heuristic way of looking at it and probably not very rigorous, is that after these upticks, they go to something back, to something where you could almost say there's no equilibrium, that they're relatively short, with the possible exception of the Single European Act, which is about 1 or 2 years. What has not been short, although it has, is actually since the crisis, and you could say that's just the crisis. So we have, if you want, one has to be careful about whether it's an equilibrium, but certainly the last 4 or 5 years, a longer resettlement than there has been at any other time, as I read the polls. So this is interesting to me. And it could be, as someone like Mayoni says, it's just the EU does different things now, and that is the crisis. Now, you make the point about the core, and that is an interesting point. But the interesting thing about the core, of course, is they are, I was talking about the original six, with the exception of Italy, they, of course, in a sense, are least in terms of fiscal adjustment. They've been relatively unconstrained by the crisis compared to other states. That, going back to Angela Merkel's lecturing, yes, the Germans have been able to meet their targets very easily, but that's because the cost of borrowing has been so ridiculously good for them, as has been the exchange rate. France hasn't, and so forth. So if one was looking at what I'd call social laws, the cost of welfare laws, etc., who have had to make particularly strong adjustments, there you found it's been found particularly challenging in some states. Now, whether that is a dominant variable, I can't say. I do say that I think this is a different context. This should be explored. If I said more than that, I was overstating my position.
Sarah,
thanks a lot. My question is really back to your fundamental suggestion about the challenge to political community, because I completely buy the various flaws that you have highlighted, that how EU law challenges political community. But is it not a challenge to political community between the territoriality that we see in Europe now of states? Because your examples, several of your examples, but the one, for example, of the Slovak worker, really shows that it's perhaps a challenge to states and the application of law, but the individual's rights that we must say must be a fundament for political community are certainly not respected if we do not have a transborder European law that secures those rights because of the mobility we see of people, goods, etc. at the moment. So I still haven't understood entirely where the problem lies, because the challenge to states and their role in the European community and their sovereignty is evident. But at the same time, the respect for the individuals and the mobilization we see today in Europe must be what triggers the political community, and the rights that go, that are necessary for that mobility, cannot come from national level in the first place. So the your suggestions, I think, point to some key challenges, but I'm not sure if we can have this very territorial application of solutions once again.
Okay, I'll try and answer. Maybe I don't... Come back to me if I haven't understood your question properly. Firstly, I should say that this idea of political community that I set out, based around the body politic, is not one that I'm actually particularly comfortable with. I mean, maybe this is, I saw this at the end. The body politic is, amongst lawyers, it's seen as a rather archaic notion of sovereignty that has justified centralized power and a certain degree of intolerance of difference. And as I suggested, it doesn't work particularly well, in my view at least, for the challenges of the EU that we have at the moment. That EU law poses problems beyond these areas, and it doesn't give us ways of EU law addressing problems of political community in a way that's not repugnant. So I use that to show there's actually just more of a continuity than people realise. It's just always been there, and that we need to reimagine things. So that's the first thing, and I think we might agree there. Now, your second point, if I understood it rightly, was, well, the EU gives individuals a lot, because it really gives individuals rights at the expense of states. So not just then the argument is, gives individuals rights, obviously, to move freely and to receive goods. But one can also make the argument that the EU can, within a political community, the EU can represent interests that are poorly represented. This is the non-majoritarian thesis. So future interests such as financial services or the environment, minority interests that are never protected well by majority institutions, such as ethnic and racial groups, diffuse interests that can't, collective action problems, so there's gender consumers, these have all been well represented by the EU. So the argument is, isn't the EU democratic? That's all very well, and I would agree with that, but I don't think it's a trumping argument, because just take the argument of mobility. And I think it's better to put it in terms of mobility than foreign nationals versus nationals. I think what one has in the EU at the moment is, what are the relative rights of the mobile versus the immobile? If we were really concerned about Romanian citizens, the poorest Romanian citizens are in Romania. They're not in the UK. If it was genuine transnational solidarity we were thinking about, we would be thinking about them. Okay? It's those that can make their way here that happen to fall into one or other entitlement here, that it is not a progressive system, particularly as EU agricultural policy largely forced a lot of these people off their land in the Central East European states. So if one was thinking about a system of social justice, it would not be designed the way it is. And so there are entitlements for both the mobile and the immobile. And it's, the question is how you balance those. And there's no, there can be no a priori rule. If we want to give the mobile certain entitlements, so an EU citizen that comes here gets certain benefits, we also have to think how that impacts on the immobile. And in the US, it's quite interesting. Within the US, between states, it's not always the case that things are portable from one state to another, for example. So that's the first thing, that the EU is very partial in its allocation of benefits, even if one was wanting a system of transnational solidarity. The other problem, I speak as someone who would say if we left the EU, we'd still apply all EU law because most of its policies are very sensible. The challenge I have with it, and I give labour law as an example, and Vanuk is a good example as well, is that it's administrative and judicial created law. And one of the reasons people don't like Vanuk is the idea that an obscure Slovenian case is changing people's insurance. Even though you could, I mean, from a British perspective, done by a foreign court. And that's the same for anyone that's not Slovenian. If it was done by Parliament, that would be a different matter. And it is the growth of non-majoritarian institutions. It's not necessarily European ones. And this, to my mind, is a big challenge. And one of the problems you see, a good example is labour law. We have a situation in the UK where until recently, there was not much mobilisation for labour law rights because it was all done at the EU law level. Now, the reality was, or a large part of it, the reality was the EU has not been legislating in significant ways in labour law for a number of years, so there was just no contestation. We moved quickly to a world of zero-hour contracts and lack of mobilisation and relying on civil servants in Brussels. And that, for me, is not a good way to protect workers' rights here in the UK. There's an atrophy that takes place.
Okay, we'll just collect a few questions now, and then Damian can give his final answer. Sonia?
I'm curious how the different stages, I guess I would call them, of the different relationships between national and EU law over time have affected rounds of enlargement. And I'm especially interested post-2004, you called it the disobedience phase, right? And whether this has any implications for future rounds of enlargement as well, and how countries sort of respond to the different dynamics between the EU and national laws.
I can say how I think it'll play out in terms of enlargement. I mean, leaving aside the obnoxious comments of David Cameron about this, about putting sort of income thresholds, unless Ukraine or Turkey is admitted, and Turkey, well, you know, then Europe would be bordering ISIS. So I think there are particular challenges. It just will not be a significant issue if you just look at the relative populations. And my own view is that the dynamics are much more complicated rather than just saying states whose relative wealth is less than other states. What I think will become issue is that, of course, even UKIP, have to admit, if we became all UKIPers, the reality is most EU citizens would be able to remain here because they've been resident here so long. And the issues will increasingly become issues of family reunification. Other issues, can you bring elder parents over to the UK for UK health services? And I would imagine that this is the next issue the Daily Mail will turn its attention to in 4 or 5 years. But of course, by then things will be a lot more entangled because people have been living here a long time. There'll be much more established parts of the community, but not as black and white. But that's my own view.
Okay, so I'll just then allow myself a final question, as I don't see any. And that's, so I really like your notion of the political community, but one thing I was a little confused about was you seem to assume that the national political communities are the ones that are stable, whereas in fact, as you know well, of course, these are imagined, constructed communities that have existed for different lengths of time. not these eternal communities, although they might be imagined as such. They are exactly that, imagined, constructed, some of them very new, some of them a bit older, nonetheless. So, but you seem to, in your chat, this idea that the EU challenges these imagined communities, not really consider the fact that, of course, the EU is also emerging, or could be emerging, as another imagined communities with exactly many of the same characteristics as these communities that they're now, that the EU is now supposedly challenging. And if that is so, where does that leave your thesis? I mean, in a sense, does the, if the EU emerges as more of a political community in itself, and as it does so, you know, in a sort of, you know, that's the constructivist view, you know, the Habermasian view, is that that's in fact what's happening, and you will develop these kind of, you know, whatever, constitutional patriotism and these allegiances towards, you know, that hasn't always existed at the national level. So isn't this just a transitional phase?
Well, it might be. Maybe I wasn't, I think the problem was I wasn't clear enough about my notion of political community. So the way you use political community is a bit how Habermas is it. I don't understand it in those terms exclusively, because he doesn't talk about the first bit, that to have a political community. My view is the idea there's some sort of demos or public sphere out there, and then we create rulers, it's wrong. That is not what happens. Political systems generate themselves. They then generate a vocabulary of political community in whose name they act. And you need both to be in.
Well, we have
present.
A lot of rules, no, in the EU.
Yes.
It's a very thick book you're
reading. But you do not have a system. You do, but you have a lot of rules, but you do not have a rule. Not even the Court of Justice says that. The Court of Justice says there's a rule of law for EU institutions. It's never said the EU rules member states. And it's an this isn't just a semantic difference, because it goes to, when I said for rule, you need to have a situation where we say to come together, to do things together, and just be together. So for the EU to be a political community, you would have to have an EU Bill of Rights, which doesn't just apply to govern EU activities, but is self-standing, which may one day happen, but it hasn't happened at the moment. You would have to have some notion of EU territory. You would have to have some notion, and this is what the German Constitutional Court, of a proper representation of a community of free and equals. Now, this is not saying, it just has to legally establish it. Now, I think if it did that, you would have a European political community. Whether that's a wise thing to do is another matter. And Habermas sort of admits that. He sort of sneaks it in a tiny bit when he says, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful? We'd all be, you know, it's a cosmopolitan community. And he says, and then he says, by the way, we could only do this, where everyone would talk together, is if the EU did things that matters. So I said, in order to have this transnational community where everyone talks together, the first thing I want to do is set up an administrative system where the EU taxes you all. Because people only talk to each other if the EU taxes them directly. And, you know, and once you start with that way, that was how states established themselves. This is how, I mean, we got representatives and the emergence of the budget. But the budget, when it emerged, was because first there'd been a huge growth of administrative power. The state had been taking more and more taxes to justify its own army, its growth of administration. And I'm not sure myself if I necessarily want that at a pan-union level. So he sneaks this in, but he knows that deep down. You have to have this institutional presence for a political community. And I don't see much movement towards that at the moment.
Okay, thank you very much. On that note, unfortunately this session is over, but there is a reception to celebrate Damien's amazing lecture, and of course to celebrate Lex and our prize winners here tonight. So there will be reception and free drinks, I think, just outside the door here now, where we can continue challenging Damien on his hypothesis. So thank you.